Everybody, I would just like to start by showing you a very quick clip from zefrank.com. This guy's pretty interesting. He's done some quite creative stuff. One thing I was reading earlier in the year was he sent out a message to all his contacts on Facebook if anyone would give up their Facebook to him for a week. And so he took complete control over their Facebook account and pretended to be them, sending out messages to all of their friends and everything for an entire week. And there's some really interesting stuff that he's written about that, and also the girl whose account was taken over and how she realised she had a Facebook addiction. So I'd just like to show you a very quick clip about social networking.
Social network built just for two. Maybe you could invite me, and I could invite you. We can lie about ages, customize all our pages, the falling letters that say, I love you. OMG, I would tell you in that picture of you taking a picture of you holding the camera in the bathroom mirror for me. Parentheses, cause you don't really be in my about me, baby. And we'd be online all the time, pretending to drink wine, typing all TFL, late into the night.
Okay, so I hope that will woke you up a little bit this morning. I think that's a really good example of how a social network might not work. I think in the community sector we often get left behind by a lot of technologies. But I think that as far as Web 2 technologies go, I think we've got a really great potential to be able to engage with that, engage with communities that we're already working with really well. So I know a lot of people have got a lot of questions about how we can be using all of these things, and hopefully today, this morning's panel will shed some light on that. So I'd first like to introduce Scott Hollier, Dr. Scott Hollier. Scott Hollier has completed a PhD entitled The Disability Divide, an examination into the needs of computing and internet-related technologies by people who are blind or vision impaired. Scott has a background in computer science and a wealth of experience in both the information technology and not-for-profit sectors. This morning, Scott's going to look at the policies and strategies and practical ways to assess the new disability divide, ensuring that people with disabilities are given every opportunity to participate in Web 2.0 community. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very, very much for the opportunity to speak here today. As introduced, the topic we're looking at is Web 2.0, evolution or e-exclusion. Just to give you a little bit of background about the organisation I work for, a company I work for is called Media Access Australia, and we're a not-for-profit organisation basically designed to work with other organisations in helping meet their access needs. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we might be able to help towards the end. As introduced, I also have a bit of an academic background. And I also have a personal knowledge about this area as I'm legally blind. I have an eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa. In my particular case, it means I have very narrow tunnel vision, so I can sort of just see my hands there. I have no night vision, so in dark areas it's a little bit tricky. And I have a bit like when you look at the sun, you look away, you get that flashing in front of your eyes. I have that all the time. Now, unfortunately, the prognosis for my eye condition isn't great. But I originally come from Perth, and a lot of my friends from Perth reckon that the only disability I really have is the fact that I follow St Kilda in the football. Although the way things are going, I think there's going to be more West Australians playing for the Saints and West Coast at this rate. So, what we'll do is we'll look a bit at, firstly, why should you care about the needs of people with disabilities? Now, I have a feeling I'm preaching to the converted on this one, but I'll give you a few tips on how you may be able to talk to others and convince them that this is an important issue. Then we'll look at the evolution. What was the web like before Web 2.0, and what difference did that make for people with different disabilities? We'll then look at the exclusion. What's happening out there at the moment? What are the key issues, and how can we address them? And then we'll look a bit at the future. What's on the horizon that's really promising, and what can we all do to make a difference? So first, cases for accessibility. Why should you care about this issue? I sort of look at it as four major cases. The first being the moral or the social argument. We live in a global community. We have a certain obligation to try and help each other. And personally, I think the moral case is the best argument. But if I can't convince you on moral grounds, maybe we can look at the educational case. The educational case argues that if there is about 60% unemployment amongst many disability groups, then if we make our government websites accessible, if we make educational institution applications accessible, increased education means less unemployment, means less poverty. So on an educational basis, I think there's a great opportunity here to make a difference. Thirdly, if I can't convince you on education or moral grounds, maybe the almighty dollar could be a good motivator. The corporate case says that if 1 in 5 Australians have some form of permanent disability, then it's a great big number, which you might be missing out on in terms of trying to get your product out there. There's been a lot of attention recently on the world financial crisis, and I think in this day and age people want to reach as many clientele as possible, and so the corporate case might be something worth pitching to others. But if I can't convince you on moral, educational or corporate case, maybe the threat of being sued is a good motivator. As many of you are aware, in the year 2000, a blind man named Bruce Maguire took the Sydney Organising Committee for the Olympic Games to court. He was successful with the Human Rights Equal Opportunity Commission, as it was then known, and that set a legal precedent in Australia regarding web accessibility. More recently, Target USA, just a few months ago, had to settle out of court because of accessibility issues. So this issue is still prominent and still important. Prior to Web 2.0, the internet, as we know, was pretty much a basic information and communication resource. Information was mainly delivered one way, from the web to the user, communication, email, instant messenger and IRC. The internet itself was very profound and has affected all of us, of course. But for people with disabilities, the advantages are even more profound. And there are three things that IT and the internet have really delivered through that initial teething period of the internet, which has made a tremendous difference to people with disabilities. The first is being able to access previously inaccessible information. It doesn't sound like much, but to be able to take a book, put it on a scanner, and convert it into an electronic format has made a tremendous difference to people who need to be able to manipulate data in a way that makes it more accessible. And that moves on to the second point, in which, thanks to the ability to change colours, change fonts, change text, the internet and computing have made a tremendous difference. To use myself as an example, the reason my PowerPoint is coloured this way is because if I had dark coloured text on a light background, it would be very difficult for me to read. So just that very simple change makes a huge difference to people with disabilities. But really, the biggest advantage is the last point, and that is independent access to information. And I can't stress this enough. 20 years ago, to use myself as an example, if I wanted to go and read a book or find some information, I'd need to go to a library, I'd need to ask someone to help me, I'd probably need it converted into Braille or audio. Today, I can fire up my computer, I can change it to what I need to do, I can install assistive technology products, and I can independently do that. I can do that myself. And the arrival of the internet, I think it's fair to say we've never lived in an age where people with disabilities have had such a great opportunity to get involved. Web 2.0 has heralded a huge amount of change. And one of the really interesting things about Web 2.0 is that rather than having sort of mainstream and disability-specific benefits, a lot of what has emerged in Web 2.0 has really converged and rolled them all together. And this has made a huge difference. A few things here which I think are particularly important is the choice of media that we have now to gather information. So, you know, whether we want to look at things on a podcast or a vodcast, off a web page, radio, we just have so many options now as to how we want to access our information. For people with disabilities, this is even more of a benefit because, you know, if you're hearing impaired, you can pull up a video with captions. If you're vision impaired, you can listen to audio, or you can go to a web page and get your text read out in your favourite voice with your assistive technology. So choice has made a big difference to people with disabilities. Then we have real-time delivery of video and streaming of internet TV. If those of you who haven't come across Live Station, unfortunately it's not very accessible at the moment, but it's a very good example of good quality TV, which is free and delivered on the internet. And it just shows you that, you know, not only is that beneficial to the mainstream population, but if I'm watching my local TV broadcast and I find that there aren't captions on that TV show, you know, in theory, I could then go and watch the same thing on the internet or from another country or find a similar news article on Euronews, for example. So, again, the wealth of options to access is huge. And then we have things like Skype and real-time communication. I've heard some wonderful stories recently about what a benefit this is to people with disabilities, but before I do, I'll just share a little story of my own. I have a one-year-old son and a nearly three-year-old daughter. And my having recently moved from Perth to Sydney, my parents were a little bit sad about missing out on my my son's first birthday. So we fired up the laptop, we set up Skype and had the video communication going, and that worked really well. They were able to see that. The funny part was that my three-year-old daughter, she was eyeing up the Black Forest cake we had for my son's birthday, and she saw the cherries on top. And she thought, maybe when Mummy and Daddy aren't looking, it'd be a really good opportunity to try and swipe one of those cherries. You can imagine her surprise when six people from the computer said, "Stop!" Sprung by Skype. It's beautiful to watch. For people with disabilities, there are additional benefits to that. And one of those is that I've heard a lot of stories now about people who are hearing impaired now being able to sign to each other through Skype. So, you know, there are applications that are happening in Web 2.0, and also I include broadband in this. You know, it's just amazing to see what's going on. And just the last point there, looking at, collaboration. Yep. Looking at collaboration, one of the really great things that we can all do on the internet is collaborate. So with cloud computing, Google Docs, you know, we can all work together. Of course, social networking. And in terms of people with disabilities, it's a great thing as well. Mobility is one of the biggest issues, and so to be able to work on documents anywhere, anytime. I know of a hearing impaired lady who just loves things like Facebook because from her point of view, it doesn't matter if she acknowledges her disability or not because it all works the same way. And Web 2.0 is really heralding great new advantages. However, there is the e-exclusion aspect of it. And here are some of the sort of key issues that are currently holding back some of those Web 2.0 benefits. And the number one thing is broadband. Personally, I think broadband is to people with disabilities like rain is to drought-stricken farmers. And I think we have to understand that without broadband, we are so limited. I don't know if you've ever tried to load a picture into, say, Flickr through dial-up. If we don't have to go back that far to realise that, you know, if we take away broadband, things become very difficult, if not impossible, to interact in Web 2.0, and broadband is certainly a huge issue. One of the examples, of course, which has been with us through web and Web 2.0, is website accessibility, which still remains a key issue in terms of making sure that people with disabilities can use their assistive technology to access information. And although things are improving, that is still a problem. An example I was giving about different formats. Unfortunately, a lot of those different formats on the internet aren't very well supported as they are in, say, terrestrial broadcasts. So, you know, if you fire up pretty much any news service on TV, it'll have captioning. Unfortunately, even if those things are captioned, to use BBC World as an example, BBC World is captioned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but if you watch it through Live Station, which is, you know, great software that it can do it, but currently there's no captioning support. There's very little captioning on the net, and virtually no audio description. So there is still some work to be done there. And in terms of cloud computing is what I see to be a wonderful and a huge opportunity for people with disabilities. Once upon a time, if you wanted to access mobile computing as a person with a disability, you'd have to buy $4,000, very expensive, custom-made PDA devices. Now you can buy a netbook computer. For those not familiar, it's the very small, cheap laptops which are around now, like the Acer C. $500, you can stick your assistive technology software on it, and it's still half the price. So getting access to the cloud on the hardware side has improved greatly, but how accessible are Google Apps? How accessible is MobileMe? How accessible will Microsoft's forthcoming cloud applications be? These are questions that haven't been really effectively answered yet, and I think some areas need to be explored. At the end of the day, though, broadband is still really the key, and I'd like to just quickly show you a few little stats on what's going on out there in broadband and maybe what we can do to look at those issues. So I apologise for the age of this data. The ABS will be publishing great new data next year. So these stats are probably a little old now, but do give you some idea. As of 2006-2007, about 73% of people had a computer in the home, about 64% had internet. That figure would, needless to say, be higher now, as you can see by the graph. In terms of the broadband dial-up split, it was about... about 70-30 in this. I believe that's more like 80-20 now. It's about 80% broadband. Here's a few sort of anecdotal stats which I think do help tell a little bit of the picture as to what's going on at the moment. So you see there that about 28% of people with core disability, now that's not all disabilities, but core disabilities have access to broadband. In terms of people aged 65 to 74, I think that's about 42% less likely to have access to broadband, and about 14% of people with disabilities are less likely to have access to internet in their home. So you can see that there is still this disability divide, as I term it, and there is some work to be done. So that's sort of the exclusion. So what can we now do as our various organisations from government and industry and not-for-profit, what can we all do together to try to address some of these issues? In terms of broadband, we've got a bit of a list here. First up, I should also acknowledge that CTN and Media Access Australia wrote a report called Broadband for All Australians, of which we outline a lot of this, and this is available on our website for those interested. Universal availability. It stands to reason that in this day and age, you know, everyone should have the opportunity to access some type of broadband. Quality of service. I don't know about you, but I know many people have had experiences where their broadband isn't as reliable as perhaps it should be. Regulation. I would argue that broadband should be deemed to be an essential service in this country. I think if we haven't reached that point now, surely we will very soon. And I think that there is opportunity for government to look at that issue. Affordability, pretty straightforward. Service offerings. I don't know how many of you have gone and tried to buy a mobile phone recently, but if you're like me, it seems like an awfully daunting task with different plans and free hours and free bits and pieces. It's even harder in terms of trying to figure out broadband, I feel. And now a lot of those type of plans are all bundled together, which I think may make it even more confusing. I think there's an opportunity for the telcos and for different providers to try to simplify that process a little bit. We've got equipment. I think it would be great if the federal government looked at assistive technology provision and looked at the way of subsidising that. Some states already do that. But, yeah, I think there is room for addition and support of that. So if you do have a disability and you are trying to get set up, is there a support mechanism available? Media Access Australia plays a big role in trying to address these, and we also eagerly try to work with other organisations who are looking to address these to try and make a difference. Outside of broadband, there are a few other issues. In terms of building web pages, as many speakers have already said here, make sure that if you do build web pages that they conform with the W3C Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It does make a tremendous difference to people with disabilities trying to access information. If you are going to be putting a video online in the near future, consider making it captioned, or maybe you can even look at audio description. I think there's a great scope there, and also in WCAG 2.0 it does talk about captioning and audio description, so there's room there. Cloud computing. if you haven't built a cloud computing application and you're a developer and it hasn't happened yet, I'd almost be willing to bet $100 that within the next 5 years you will be building some type of cloud computing application. When you do, consider using the accessibility features built into most tools available now. Visual Studio, for example, for Microsoft, has accessibility features built in that you can turn on and help check. It's not perfect, but it's a good start. Cocoa on the Mac, another good example. Flash has a lot of good captured support now. And just a few bits and pieces in terms of Media Access Australia. As I was saying, my basic role is to try and help and support other organisations. So if you have a project and you need to address access issues, give me a call. You know, if I can provide you with some information, you can just fire off an email and I'll fire one back. If you'd like further consultancy, we'd be happy to work on projects together, putting grants together. Or if you want me in person to come and work with you, if you can rummage up some travel money and accommodation, then I'll be there. So I'm very serious when I say that we want to do everything possible to try and support you and your access needs. Now, I know it all sounds a bit doom and gloom, you know, to think that we've come so far and yet still have a lot of these issues. But just the past 2 months has been very exciting to see a lot of change in this area. And there's just a few positive things I want to share with you about the future and why I really do believe that it's only a matter of time, and especially with an audience such as this, where together we do get there and that industry is taking some of these things on board. I've noticed that the federal government and state governments do seem to be having more collaboration about the broadband rollout, and I've noticed that despite the financial crisis, broadband rollout does still seem to be on the agenda, which gives me a lot of encouragement, and I've been privy to some information that's been changing between federal and state governments about the issue, and that's very encouraging. Another encouragement is Windows 7, which has been in the press a lot recently. I'm actually getting my hands on a copy of it next week, which I'm very excited about to see what it is like in accessibility. But although Microsoft won't officially announce it till January, it has been shown from other people who have tested the current pre-beta that it has a full-featured screen magnification built in, which means, in theory, you wouldn't have to buy $2,000 assistive technology software anymore. For the Mac fans out there, you've already had this for several years, but Microsoft will catch up eventually. But it's an encouraging sign given that Vista was hoped to be a great accessible operating system, and although a lot happened under the bonnet, not much on the surface. So I think this is an encouraging sign that perhaps, big organisations are stepping up to the plate. YouTube have had, just in the past week, have released a tremendous mashup. What you can do now is if you go to YouTube Clip with Captions, there's a little pull-down bar on the player which lets you instantly translate those captions to any one of 36 different languages. It's not perfect in terms of its translation, of course, but I just think this is a tremendous step forward. And to take a very traditional access medium like captioning for broadcasts and change it into something which really works well on the Web 2.0 platform, I think heralds tremendous hope for the future. And last not least, and Jonathan talked about this yesterday, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 2, absolutely, definitely, positively, maybe almost here in December. So according to their website, it will be, and that's good enough for me. So I think that it's going to be terrific when this is finally here. For those not aware, WCAG 2.0 has been very controversial during its development. There's many tall tales and anecdotes I'd be happy to share with you at the break if you're interested. But I think once it is released, you know, the current guidelines were made in 1999. Technology has progressed somewhat since then, and it's going to be a great thing. So just to wrap up, people with disabilities are currently facing an e-exclusion when it comes to trying to get access to Web 2.0. Having said that, though, we are in a great opportunity and a great place to really make a difference in the area. The case I like to think back is the education argument. And I think that, you know, you can all know that the work that you do, it really does improve educational opportunities for people with disabilities. That really does reduce unemployment, and that really will reduce poverty. And I just think it is a great privilege to be in such an area where we can all work together to really make that difference. It's also been a great privilege to talk to you all today. And as I was saying before, if there's anything I personally can do to help on Media Access Australia, it would be a great, absolutely great opportunity to do so. Thank you very much.
We were going to wait till the end to ask questions, but if anyone's got any questions now, we're just going to take a few questions right now. So, questions? Anyone? Yep.
You mentioned Apple and Microsoft as far as accessibility. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Linux?
There's a fair bit of development in Linux, especially on the KDE side of things. Sun have done a lot of work just recently. The trouble is that if you buy, say, or pick up Ubuntu, for example, it has a lot of accessibility to add on, but when you buy, well, when you install a system by default, it doesn't come with a lot of those accessibility features. So Linux does have a lot. It's developing more and more all the time. And, from the reports I've heard, particularly Ubuntu with its source, it's in reasonably good shape at the moment. But in terms of a choice of platform, like off-the-shelf product, Mac OS is still the most accessible operating system on the market at the moment.
Okay, up the back in the grey.
In two parts to that question. First one, how accessible are they? Not very, unfortunately, is the answer at the moment. Most social networking sites do lack conformity to the W3C standards. In terms of where to go, there is very little information out there at the moment. What I'm trying to do at Media Access Australia, and I haven't done this specifically to social networking, but I've put a lot of resources on our Media Access Australia website in new media. There's a user toolkit which looks at things like what choices do I need to make if I want to buy a computer that's accessible, how do I make my web browser accessible, through to developer's toolkit, which then looks at how do I build a website, how do I develop internet applications, making PDFs accessible and things like that. I'm updating that all the time. So, whilst there isn't a lot of information on that at the moment, if anyone here comes across information along those lines, please send it to me and I'll make sure that that goes up on our website. So, there's not a lot out there because basically it's not accessible. But, I think with time and especially a lot of developers I've heard on the traps are waiting to see how WCAG 2.0 shakes out before they make commit to too much at the moment. So hopefully, after those guidelines are released, we'll see some improvement.
Just one more.
I think that's a great point. Just to share on that issue a little something from my thesis. When I initially did my research, the assumption I made was that the reason why there's such a gap is because people with disabilities try to get access to things, find it too hard, and give up. And that was sort of my initial assumption as to why there's such a gap. But as I did my research, I found out actually I was wrong. What happens is that people with disabilities have as much, if not more, knowledge about the benefits that IT and computing can provide. And the reason is because they do see it as the answer to access. And what actually happens is that people with disabilities, they do try to access these things. They do find it very hard and they do run into barriers, but they will keep trying and they will keep trying until they eventually get through. And I think that's the really important thing to remember with that question is absolutely, people are trying MySpace, they are trying Facebook, although there are accessibility issues. I would certainly encourage people to keep trying. And the great thing we know is that once we do get it right, the floodgates will open in terms of people with disabilities jumping on these things and taking advantage of them. So I think this is why with Web 2.0 and those benefits, the mainstream and the disability-specific benefits have converged because you know, it's this great opportunity. And as it becomes accessible, then people are very, very quick to take advantage of that.
Okay, thank you, Scott. We're just going to have to move on now to our next speaker, Robin Cummins. Robin is the Manager of Information Services at the Spastic Centre in New South Wales. Robin's team is responsible for the centre's multiple websites and intranet, publishing and information services to clients, families and staff of the organisation. The innovative environment at the Spastic Centre has allowed Robin and her team to adapt their service to new technologies and practices have emerged. She'll be talking today on planning for change, and I'm going to let her introduce everything about what she's going to talk about. And thank you to Robin for standing in at the last minute.
Okey-doke. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. So today I'm going to talk about four things. The first, I'm going to define what I call the attributes of Web 2, because everyone has slightly different definitions of it, so that we can start thinking about how we can go from here. The second thing I'm going to do is to give a quick overview of some of the initiatives that we've been working on at the Spastic Centre. The third is to how you can shape your organisation to be ready for the next wave of change, whatever that might be. And the fourth thing is my wish list, which I had a lot of fun with. Just to give a bit of context, with cerebral palsy, we've had a lot of conversation about accessibility for people with vision impairment in particular, which is very important. Cerebral palsy, I think, is something that not a lot of people know about, and that's our primary stakeholder group at the Spastic Centre. It's a physical condition, a physical disability that affects movement, and it's caused by damage to the developing brain of a baby. It usually occurs before birth. There's no known cause and there's no known cure, and it's a lifelong condition. It affects about 1 in 400 babies in Australia, so that's quite significant. And there's about 33,000 people in Australia who have cerebral palsy. As Scott was saying, technology, like for vision-impaired people, has been just this enormous breakthrough for people with cerebral palsy for many of the same reasons. So Web 2, this is how I define it. It's social. It's based on relationships and conversations. It's participatory. The readers become the content creator and finally has a voice. It harnesses the power of the group, and that's the lovely thing. It's enabled people across the world to join together to work on joint projects, share information and create new knowledge. The whole idea of crowdsourcing or Wikonomics. It's democratic and it's often leaderless, or at least with distributed leadership. It's global. Usage and readership have nothing to do with national boundaries or cultural differences. It's mobile and it's increasingly going to be more mobile. It's individual, so that you can now tailor your web interactions so that the web content comes to you. You don't have to go to it anymore. And it offers new versions of reality. We can now experience very, very rich three-dimensional online virtual worlds. So for the Spastic Centre, we've been involved in a number of projects and have plans for more projects. The first was CP Blogs, which I talked about yesterday. Just briefly, we launched this project in June of this year. There are four blogs. The first is called Hey Dad, which is written by a wonderful father called Rodney Clark about the ups and downs of family life when you have a child with a disability. He has an 11-year-old son with cerebral palsy. Free Fall is written by a 20-something woman who has cerebral palsy about leaving home and taking chances in the big world. Web2Go is written by a journalist, Jenny Kapp, who has cerebral palsy, and it's all about new technologies, about web applications and other really good computer stuff, not only just for people with a disability, but really for everyone. And The Scene, which was a popular e-newsletter, which we've converted into a blog. And they've all been really, really popular and really successful. We're very fortunate when you do a Google search for cerebral palsy, the Spastic Centre's About Cerebral Palsy page is number one in an Australian search for cerebral palsy and number two in a worldwide search below Wikipedia. So we have them actually linked from that page, and I think that's helped drive traffic to them. They're based on a premise, which is my mantra, that the best knowledge comes from people living the experience. And after 10 years as an organisation of having a website, this was actually the first time that the authentic voice of people with cerebral palsy and their families was allowed a platform on our website, and I was a really passionate campaigner for that. The second thing we're doing at the moment is building a social networking website with some of our adult clients so they can renew old friendships and forge new ones. We're building it in Ning, which I found out about at the Making Links conference last year, so that's very exciting. The lovely part about this is that it's really hard for our clients to get together face-to-face. A lot of them have communication impairments. You know what it's like with accessible taxis. Well, certainly in Sydney, it's pretty tragic. But online, the playing field is equal, and they can get together online both in an asynchronous way and in a synchronous way through this Ning platform. Everyone will have a role in this community, and they've all each been identifying the sorts of roles that they'll have as a social host, as a content writer, to share their music or videos or photos, as technical experts, as teachers or as mentors. And so each of them actually see one or more roles for themselves. And I guess you all know this because you're all involved in community development. The process is as important as the outcome with this one. And so every decision about the development of this site is being made by a steering group of 15 people with cerebral palsy. The development, the governance, the design, the content, you know, the rules, everything is being made, and I'm just facilitating the process. We also dabble in virtual worlds. Some of you might have seen the YouTube video of one of my team members, Judith, yesterday. Judith is really a real aficionado of Second Life. So during work time, when she's got a spare minute, she's actually a desktop publisher, I let her surf around in Second Life and in the new Google one called Lively, I think it is, where she just sees what's going on. She talks to people about disability. And the best thing is that during our work hours is actually the hours when the people in the UK and the US are online, so there's more people in Second Life during our work time. Sometimes when she goes out of work hours, there's not many people around. So she just sort of reports back to me and just tells me what's going on, which is really good. The Spastic Centre uses a number of social sites for fundraising and awareness raising. YouTube, like everybody. We use Everyday Hero. I don't know whether you've got onto that, but it's the most brilliant, brilliant website. And we also have our own fundraising website called My Challenge, which we've built or developed by the people that have developed our CRM, our fundraising software, and they've built this for us. And we primarily at the moment use it for an event that we hold every March in conjunction with Macquarie Bank, but we'll be developing it in the future for other social fundraising. So to try and get some of our staff a bit more web savvy, we've introduced an online learning tool called Illuminate, which is a classroom collaboration tool. And from 2009, a number of our professional development activities will be held in Illuminate, which will cut down our carbon footprint. We'll stop flying as many people to Sydney for training. So that was one of the selling points. We have a Google email group for some of our adult clients, who most of whom sort of live by themselves and are fairly socially isolated. And we've also just received funding to develop a series of podcasts for families to buy them iPods and pre-record a whole lot of podcasts to load onto the iPods, which we'll also make available on our website and iTunes and so on free of charge. So I'd just like to share some thoughts with you about how we got to the point where we were ready to catch this wave of Web 2 and how some of the same principles could apply for you at your organisations for Web 2 or Web 3 or, you know, wherever we go from here. To my mind, there are three factors that influence an organisation's ability to adopt new practices. The first is being thoroughly in touch with the needs of your clients or your stakeholders. Through consultations, through surveys, through anecdotal feedback from your staff, from the academic literature, we actually mustn't forget that in our field. But also start listening to the conversations they're having with each other on the web, because they're saying stuff to each other that they would never say to us, and really that's where you find out what really actually will make a difference in their lives. The second thing is keeping on top of web trends, and I know it's really hard, but it's really, really important for us. I suppose I'm preaching to the converted here, but come to conferences like this, you pick up so much good stuff that will, you know, good ideas and stuff that will save you money. Reading really widely, listen to the technology podcasts on the BBC and all around the world. Watch teenagers and see what they're doing. I watch my teenage kids and I'm just blown away by what they're getting into, and they're using technology in ways that I'm sure the inventors never even thought of. And always just be on the lookout for ideas for initiatives that could be adapted for your needs. The third part is really having a receptive organisational culture that encourages innovation. That's harder to control, obviously, but if you can try to align your initiatives with some strategic goal or outcome that the senior management wants to achieve, that also obviously maps back to your client or stakeholder needs, then it's really much easier to sell. So all of these things, what I'm suggesting you do is become a knowledge broker, and I'll just explain what that is. Knowledge brokering is a term that's being used a lot in the academic world around brokering research evidence to policymakers and to service practitioners. Basically, the academics are saying we're producing all this great research, but nobody's taking it up. So that's where the terms come from. And if you formally define it, they talk about it encompassing a range of formal and informal activities and processes undertaken to establish relationships and facilitate effective knowledge exchange. So really, all of you guys have to be knowledge brokers, and that's what I've done in our organisation. So you've got a map and you've got a capture, most importantly, translate what's going on the web, and you've got to distill the knowledge about what's going on the web. Then you have to develop an understanding of the needs of the different stakeholders and identify opportunities and initiatives, bring them together to hear the messages, hear the stories, and scope the possibilities. And so if you do that, I believe you can reach that sweet spot in the middle where you're actually marrying all of these things together. So what are some of the attributes of a knowledge broker? This is what you've all got to be. You've got to be entrepreneurial. You've got to be a networker, a problem solver, and an innovator. You've got to be trusted and credible, build up the trust and credibility within your organisation. And one way to do that is give people stuff for free. I've been producing this research newsletter for cerebral palsy, so I just actually search the literature every week to see what's been published in the academic literature about cerebral palsy. And I've got this network around the world of people who think I'm wonderful and would do everything, anything for me, because I just send this free newsletter out every week. Got to be a clear communicator. You have to understand the needs of the different, the cultures of the different environments. You have to be able to find and assess relevant knowledge, including the research evidence. You have to facilitate, mediate and negotiate. And if you don't have those skills, then find somebody who will teach them to you. And you really must love learning and sharing new knowledge and be the sort of person that's just got your ear out the whole time. So that's the knowledge brokering. Now, here's my wish list for Web 2. So beyond Web 2, if we think of Web 2 as a spectrum, moving on, this is my wish list in no particular order. Ubiquitous mobile and individual technologies. This is starting to happen, but I'd love to see a day where somebody who is in a wheelchair, who has cerebral palsy, has a mobile phone that can tell them when they're passing a building whether it's accessible or not, to tell them when there's a thunderstorm approaching, because most people I know who are in a wheelchair don't want to be out in an electrical storm, and in fact often curtail their activities in Sydney just in case there's a storm coming in the afternoon. to tell them when the next accessible bus is coming past, or in fact when it's delayed. For assistive technologies to be developed in the same crowdsourcing way that open source software is developing, you know, that's developed around the world, and get the profit motive out of it. I'd love government departments and NGOs that allow the voice of their clients to be heard on their websites. That's a bit of democracy. I actually once suggested that at a consultation that they had for a new website for one of our major government departments in New South Wales, and they looked at me as if I was from Mars. But I noticed this morning that Kevin Rudd's just released a new website, and he said he's encouraging people to write in with their comments. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet to see whether he's making those comments publicly visible or not, but it will be really interesting to see. For websites to be accessible for people with an intellectual disability or with literacy problems, I feel we've sort of almost got right accessibility for people with vision impairment, or we're well on the track, and for mobility impairments like cerebral palsy. But for people with an intellectual disability, they're just left way behind. So we just need to have at least parts of our website that are, you know, in visual or using really simple language or pictures or whatever. And also, I think the semantic web, what they're talking about there, will allow natural language searches, which will make it a lot easier for everyone to access information. I'd love to see three-dimensional websites that are a much more immersive and richer experience for everyone, and greater access to virtual worlds like Second Life for education and for social connection. And I think the broadband uptake, as Scott was saying, will help that. So for people with a physical disability, being able to use technology to extend their bodies with implants and prosthetics that have direct brain connections, and that's actually already starting to happen in the US. Therapeutic gaming. The whole world of gaming is just amazing, and we really haven't tapped into it nearly the extent that we should. So you could use gaming to achieve really measurable therapy outcomes. Much more fun, and people can do it in a self-paced way. I know when my Wii Fit fitness instructor gets on my back for not doing it for a few days, I'm much happier than a personal trainer haranguing me. For government departments and NGOs to step up the monitoring of the conversations of what people are saying about them on the web. Corporates are already doing this. You know, the marketing people are listening to what people are saying on the web, but I don't believe the NGOs and the government departments are doing it. And connectivity of people with a disability in developing countries. People with a disability in developing countries are the lowest rung on the ladder, and they really need to be connected so they can communicate their needs and have a voice as well. And finally, this is my big wish list. I really feel strongly that with the intelligent web, there's opportunities to find answers to conditions that are really complex, like cerebral palsy, that have very complex causal pathways. There's conversations and there's literature on the web that are just like silos, and no one's connected the dots. And in the same way that in the 50s, it was mothers sitting around in waiting rooms for the hearing specialists when their children all had hearing impairments, and the mums all got talking and they found out that they'd all had German measles or rubella while they were pregnant, and that's how they discovered the connection between German measles during pregnancy and hearing impairment. I really feel strongly there are conversations and there's information that's out there about all sorts of other complex disabilities, and that if we actually had the data mining, we could connect the dots and bring those silos together and find some of the answers. So that's my big wish for the Web3, for the intelligent web. So that's it. Thank you all for listening. Do you want to take questions now?
Thank you, Robin. We'll just take a few questions now before we move on to our next speaker.
That was a silly way to do it, wasn't it? there. Is that okay?
Anybody got any questions?
No thoughts?
Yep.
Your wish list at the end.
Yeah.
Is that something that you're going to be putting into submission to the National Disability Strategy?
Yeah, we're looking at it pretty strongly. That's by the 1st of December, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker this morning is Darren Sharp. He's the Senior Researcher with Smart Services CRC based at Swinburne University. He'll be talking about the convergence between location-based technologies and participatory culture and the rise of WEAR 2.2 movement. So I think this should be really interesting. Thanks, Darren.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you here today. I'm a social media project leader with the Smart Services CRC, which is a national research centre based in Sydney. For those of you who aren't familiar with CRCs, we're sort of interesting beasts. We undertake commercially focused research in conjunction with industry partners. I work with groups like Fairfax Digital, Telstra and Census. We have government partners like the New South Wales and Queensland state governments. My background is as a social researcher, worked on a number of projects for the CRC. We've just gone from being the Smart Internet to the Smart Services CRC in our second round. And I've done research into blogs, wikis and social software. And more recently, co-authored a report with Manny Salomon on user-led innovation. Today I want to spend some time talking about something which may not be familiar to most of you called WEAR 2.0, and it's really about the future of ubiquitous computing, mobile computing. So just a quick sort of overview, I want to situate this discussion this morning within a framework of participatory culture, then talk about what WEAR 2.0 is exactly, look at some ideas that have come from people like Adam Greenfield, who's written about the and spoken about the read-write city, which I think is a really fascinating and interesting and provocative idea. Then talk about some of Peter Morville's work on ambient findability. Point to some case studies of some existing applications and services that are out there on the web. And then leave you with some provocations in terms of hopefully some ideas that could inspire you to get you thinking about what sort of tools and services and applications you could start developing within your own communities, hopefully. Okay, so participatory culture, you know, I've done a lot of work on what I'm calling the do-it-yourself internet, and, you know, it's clear that we're seeing today increasing numbers of people, whether they're audiences, whether they're citizens, whether they're customers, having a much greater input into the co-creation of the products and services that they're consuming. So I've just got a number of different areas where this is happening, where most of us are probably familiar with the free and open source software movement and, you know, really fantastic and robust applications like Mozilla's Firefox web browser, citizen journalism and blogging. We can look at, you know, interesting examples from here and overseas. One in particular would be Oh My News in Korea, where you know, you have thousands of citizen journalists, amateur journalists who are out there roving the streets, developing stories, breaking stories, having an important impact on the political process in that country. Virtual worlds have been talked about, people creating their own avatars, their own products and services in world, selling those, you know, creating their own communities, incredibly rich communities. The same within game communities as well, Wikipedia, commons-based peer production. On and on we go with user-generated content and so on and so forth. And we're seeing increasingly these sorts of processes and activities and social practices being undertaken in the real world with citizen product design. So you have companies like Threadless, a T-shirt company where they solicit designs from their user base, and people then submit designs, the community then vote on it, and the most popular designs are then created and sold back to that community. Lego has been a big advocate of user-led innovation, and through their Mindstorms product initially, now you can go to Lego site and they've got a factory service where you can actually design your own Lego toys, and the company will then manufacture them for you and then ship them out to you direct to your house, which is quite interesting. So, okay, so moving on to Wear 2.0. Basically, we can see from 2005 onwards a number of converging trends reaching a tipping point. This area is also known as neo-geography. You know, we can see with the advent of Google Maps, Microsoft Live Local, Yahoo Maps, the release of APIs, so application programming interfaces. So basically, you know, if you look at Facebook developer platform or the iTunes application store, you know, third parties who aren't associated with Facebook or Apple or any other company, Amazon, whatever one you want to talk about, having access to the data of those companies, the back end, being able to plug in, being able to co-create new services and roll those services out, growing ubiquity of mobile GIS, new protocols and standards like WiMAX and Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS, RFID, which are little microchips, which are basically, believe it or not, are going to be the new standard for barcodes. Basically, in terms of logistics, companies are starting to put these little tags on objects so they can actually track them. It's very big in the retail sector and the military sector, but it does have other uses. There are obviously risks associated with those new technologies, such as privacy, GeoRSS, geotagging, and then all of the services that we can see on the web and on mobile devices, location-based services, mobile social software, geospatial web, ubiquitous computing, pushpin applications. I'll talk about some of these. So we're seeing people becoming enabled through the uptake and use of these new services, these new applications, and having the ability to overlay rich social data onto the physical objects and places in their surrounding physical environment. So that'll probably make a bit more sense as I get into the discussion. A really important thinker in this space, one of the key thought leaders, is Adam Greenfield. He wrote a really fantastic book in 2006 called Everywhere. He's an information architect and a designer. So he talks about this future that we're entering of ambient informatics. At the Lyft conference, I think it was in Korea last year, he talked about the read-write city, and I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at Wear 2.0 and UbiComp. And he talks about a city that responds to the behaviour of its residents and other users in something like real time. He talks about the city is the platform. So in Web 2.0 parlance, we talk about the web as the platform, where it's plug and play, it's read-write, people can interact with it, they can mash things up, they can share and distribute and control and create content in new ways. And Greenfield's talking about this in a sort of physical context as these new mobile and locative and ambient devices become more ubiquitous. So he's arguing that the read-write city is organic to technological and social possibilities. Another important thought leader here is Peter Morville, another information architect and designer. He talks about ambient findability. That's his book from 2005. It's really interesting, really important to have a look at that if you're interested in all of this stuff. So he looks at the impact of UbiComp on the economy and on society and on culture. He argues that it has the potential to change people's decision-making by radically altering our relationship to trusted sources of authority. So what he's saying is that as ubiquitous computing, as ambient findability rolls out and becomes more popular and widespread, familiar activities like shopping, house hunting, tourism could be transformed by people beginning to share their opinions and experiences of all manner of landmarks, objects and places. Okay, so this is an example of user-generated placemaking. It's a startup called Street Advisor, and I believe it was developed by a couple of brothers in Melbourne, and this is now all around the world. It's been inspired by, you know, a lot of the review sites that we're seeing, like TripAdvisor. You might be familiar with that one, where you can go and look at hotel rooms all around the world and get the opinions of your peers, other people who've actually been there and can comment on it. Taking that approach, using those same principles, StreetAdvisor gives people the opportunity and the tools to actually share their experiences of their street and talk about the facilities, the parks, the services, the neighbours, you know, other sorts of things that you wouldn't have previously had access to, the sort of inside knowledge. And so this is a really interesting way for people to actually review, rate and recommend their own local neighbourhoods and then comment on that and then form communities around that. This is another interesting example called Placial, which has come out of Portland, Oregon in the States. It's a collaborative atlas, so people can create their own user-generated maps and they can share their favourite places with their peers. So it uses Google, the data from Google Maps to generate city-specific lists. And this is a typical sort of pushpin application where you can actually put a little icon on the map and you can, you know, people have done, you know, numerous things, but some of the most popular are talking about the best cafes, say, in Melbourne, or the best, you know, op shops, or the best schools, the best this, that, the other, the best bike paths. But you could basically go there and talk about, you know, the social services in your area, the, you know, what disability services are available, what are the libraries like, what are, you know, you could, it, basically the sky's the limit. And another really interesting one is Socialite, another location-based service, which is mobile-based, basically allows people to sort of post these yellow sticky notes on maps and then in a similar fashion to Placial, create their own, you know, discussions and communities around their favourite places and services in those particular locales. Places is another one. Share your location, add people you trust, and see who's crossing your path. So this might be, you know, for example, if you're out there in this, you know, somewhere in real life, you're walking down the street with your mobile, you know, using one of these services. Potentially, you could then be able to see people who are in your social network, you know, maybe a half a kilometre away around the corner, and you might be able to, you know, use that kind of serendipitous, you know, case of being in the same place at the same time and then be actually able to hook up physically because you've got that insight for using the technology that your mates are just around the corner. And so new kinds of interactions and social formations can occur using these new sorts of platforms. So Semipedia, there's a lot going on at the moment with QR codes and semicodes and M codes, basically two-dimensional barcodes which can be embedded on, you know, anything on paper, on an object, on a wall, on a billboard. Telstra has been pushing this new technology recently. You may have seen, I know in The Age at least, they've had recently lots of, you know, large ads talking about their next gen network and having little QR codes where you can take a scan of that QR code. It will then link to a web page via your mobile phone. Semipedia is taking that idea and doing something really interesting with it. So they're a non-profit and they're experimenting with physical hyperlinking and they use open source. So basically, you go to the site, you print off your mobile readable semicode or Semipedia tag and you then attach that to whatever physical location you wish. It then links back to a corresponding article in Wikipedia. If there is none, you can make one up. It's as simple as that. So this is an example of a Semipedia tag. It's a tag of Story Bridge in Brisbane. So you can imagine, you know, people spray painting this on or posting this up somewhere, just as you now have, you know, billboards all around the place. People could be adding these sorts of codes and they have started to do so. You know, you could, you know, put it up on Flinders Street Station. It would then link to, you know, the Wikipedia entry about Flinders Street Station, tell you about the history of it. It might then link you to some, you know, podcasts that will then be able to, you know, you could then download that and you could use that as like a walking tour or, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what you can do with these sorts of technologies. You know, obviously it has lots of important, you know, and interesting applications from a tourism kind of point of view, but also in terms of community services and from an activist point of view, this is a really interesting way to kind of reclaim public space and, you know, use the environment as, you know, as a platform, as Adam Greenfield has sort of argued. So there are lots of other emerging place-based services which we're starting to see and can be, I would argue you could look at these examples and see how they might be relevant to your work and what you're doing and how they could be modified or explored as opportunities to kind of lead to new, you know, communities, community formations and new services and applications that would be of benefit to your stakeholders. So urban gaming, people actually using mobile devices in an urban setting, they've done lots of these sorts of things at Federation Square where people go on sort of treasure hunts and they're using a mobile device or their PDA to kind of get clues and find things out and discover things with their friends. Geocaching is another one where people, this is like a really interesting, strange group of a subculture of people who go and bury stuff in the middle of nowhere and then they post like clues online and you use GPS to then locate this hidden treasure, and it's like a really, you know, really strong subculture all around the world. You know, ride share from like a sustainability angle, people are starting to use these, you know, Wear 2.0 services to find out, you know, who in their local neighbourhood or their community is, you know, going to Hawthorne. Say in my instance, I live in Bentley and I want to go to Hawthorne because I work at Swinburne. So who else in Bentley might be going in that sort of area so we can carpool? And, you know, so you could use mobile devices or the web in a similar way to, you know, to take advantage of these. And there's lots of these examples online at the moment. Couch surfing is a really interesting one. People sort of posting, there's lots of communities around free hospitality where people basically give up their couches and let, you know, strangers who are, you know, vetted by that community to come and stay with them for free. So you can basically, if you're a part of this community, you can go and grab a couch anywhere in the world and camp out for free. And then there's, you know, wireless community networks, you know, those distributed networks, distributed wireless, where people can basically share their broadband and their Wi-Fi. So there's any number of different ways that these new kind of emerging Wear 2.0 applications and products and services could be, you know, re-engineered or recontextualised within your own kind of setting. So provocations to action, you know, basically I'm saying that I see this as a really interesting opportunity. Obviously the technology in many cases is still new and emerging and there are access issues. But as Mark Pesce points out, you know, we now have 3 billion people around the world with access to a mobile phone. So people are now sort of leapfrogging and using the mobile platform as a way to leapfrog the PC. So how can, you know, I would argue, and I would ask you what other tools could be developed that enable, you know, your communities to collaboratively produce place with their peers. How could these new kinds of services be harnessed to aid sustainability, to assist with health services, to assist with education services and disability services? How does it force us to rethink notions of the public and private space and the commons, the real and the virtual, and the professional and the amateur? When, you know, people have access to these tools and they can then comment on their community, on their neighbourhood, on their government, you know, what impact does that have on our culture and on the political process more broadly? So hopefully that's given you some food for thought. These are my contact details. A lot of our research, that's our new website, a lot of our research can be downloaded for free on our old website, which is smartinternet.com.au, and we're undertaking lots of interesting research in this space around social media and virtual worlds and personalisation and lots of other things. So please, you know, feel free to get in touch with me and follow our activities via the website there. And I welcome your questions and comments.
Thanks, Darren. I found that really fascinating and I'm glad that it's actually Wear 2.2 and not just 2.0 and not me just thinking there's major typos going on everywhere. Is there any questions? I'm sure there's lots of questions. I read this abstract last night and was pretty fascinated by it. So we didn't have internet in our hotel room because it was evil, and I got on my mobile phone and was trying to figure it all out on my mobile phone, and I couldn't actually find a... Can you actually explain a little bit about how people actually read the codes?
Yeah, you basically, you know, if you come across a code and you've got a mobile phone that can actually decipher the bloody thing, you take a photo of it, and then if everything works correctly, that then will take you to... it's basically a two-dimensional, you know, web link, and it'll link up to whatever web page the code is referring to. And in the instance of, you know, like Semipedia, you can actually develop your own codes. That's the exciting thing. So people can start, you know, physically hyperlinking objects around their house or in public or anywhere, and, you know.
So you just print it out as a PDF or something
like
that?
Yeah, you just print it out. You print out the image and you can then have that barcode. I guess you could glue it up on a wall, or you could, you know, spray paint it if you were into that. We're big into graffiti culture in Melbourne, so... You know, you can imagine these sorts of things being, you know, sprayed on. And obviously it has lots of commercial applications, like it's a new way of advertising, but there's no reason why community groups couldn't take advantage of the same technology to get their message out there.
I think I'm going back to Perth and I'm just going to start graffiti art everywhere. Is it? Yep.
I'm not sure, but most of the new phones that are coming out now that are sort of Java enabled, you know, do have and that have cameras in them, which nearly every new phone has a camera now, should be able to kind of read those new QR codes, and that's where everything's kind of heading. So, you know, it's only a matter of time until every kind of mobile phone is able to decipher these sorts of things. I think probably the States and Australia are probably the two leaders. I think we're doing lots of interesting stuff here. There's you know, lots going on in the mobile space, particularly in there are lots of new